If you ever look at a dollar bill and you look at the front and you see George Washington's picture on the front, but if you flip it over on the back, there's a phrase on there that says, "In God we trust." We didn't trust in George Washington, although he was part of our founding and he's important to our history and the founding of this country, but we never worshiped George Washington. But he was on the front of our dollar bill. But we realized early on it was because of God, and we could trust God with all things. Now, we watched that football game last night, and it was a good football game, and I enjoy sports, and I like what they do, and I'm glad that they finally held to it. It was interesting. I was switching back and forth between Alabama and Georgia and Florida State, and I think Betty sometimes even snuck in to see what the Rays were doing. But balls, favorite, sports, all of us like sports. But did you know one of the most important lessons in learning to play any sport, but especially sports that have the round ball, which is basketball or tennis or football or soccer, is one of the most important things? You got to be alert to where the ball is. Sometimes I wondered last night, they weren't very alert on some things and they lost sight of the ball. But that's the most important thing of the game. And if you allow yourself to be distracted and look away at times, you will lose your focus, disable your ability to play astutely, and disengage from your team. And then it's a joint venture in strategy, and the other team may gain an upper hand. So keeping your eye on the ball just doesn't mean the ball itself, but means keeping your eye on the attention, giving your attention to the game and your role about being part of that team. And in your commitment to the team's mission, you just simply play to the best of your ability. This goes for nearly everything in life. You want to succeed in school? You got to keep your eye on the ball. You want to do well in business? You got to stay committed and keep your eyes on the goal, on your forecast, on your expenses. You got to be able to stay interested. Same with our relationship with Christ. And be secure in your faith. You got to keep your eye on Jesus. So don't be distracted by the ways of the world, because I'll tell you, especially in this season, the political season, the culture milieu that we're in, times of doubt and despair and peer pressure kind of creep into our faith relationship with Christ too, and it kind of waters down our discipleship. So our challenge for all of us is to stay firm in your faith by keeping your eyes on Jesus. Now, keeping your eyes on Jesus doesn't mean that you disengage from the world or your role in social or political arenas. It simply means keeping your promises straight, keeping your life in perspective, and always putting God first. In the scriptures today that we read, Jesus is confronted by a group of the Pharisees and the Herodians, which was people that followed King Herod, who wanted to challenge Jesus on his politics, hoping to twist his words, hoping to entrap him and to reveal him as a hypocrite and a revolutionary so that they can defuse his mission, or better, have him arrested for sedition. Now, in the political arena in Jesus' day, not much different than the political arena that we're in now, not just secular and foreign God worshiping and facing Rome, but a political tug of war between the Jewish politicians, the Jewish political leaders who vied for the power in the temple or the church and their providential rule. Three of the strongest of these were Pharisees. These Pharisees were educated rabbis, they were legalists, and they held power over the Jewish individual community or communal behavior. That's who they were. The Sadducees, they were a priestly family, they were preachers, they were temple power, they were to have power in the church. And then you got the Herodians, those who wanted to keep Herod's family on the Jewish thrones of power. Now you got to remember, Rome was in control of Israel at that time. Rome called that particular area of Israel Palestine. That's where the Palestinian mess came from, or whatever you want to call it in the confusion. So with Herod and his family, they wanted to be able to control that because Rome was in control. Herod was their king, and that political stuff was there. Meanwhile, these revolutionaries abounded in all three political parties. In power, they had an interesting potential of squashing any potential threats. And Jesus had amassed a following of folks that was dissatisfied with the current state of affairs. And he was seen as a definite potential threat to the political and religious structure of the day. And they were in a quandary. If they arrested him, they risked uprising. If they left him alone, they suspected they could soon lose control of their power and positions and risk disdain and rage of their benefactor, Rome. Now, they feared above all else all removal from power and loss of wealth and position. So what'd they do? They plotted to entangle Jesus in a political conundrum. They ask him, okay, tell us what you think, Jesus. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? Now, it's easy to simply focus on this sentence and read over it, but you have to look at also the preceding one. You got to be able to get context of really what's going on. But the preceding sentence is very important to the interaction because we as the reader can see them setting up Jesus for their very introduction to the question. Teacher, we know that you're sincere, you know, and they're just posturing him a little bit. And you teach the way of God according to the scriptures. And they were trying to trap him. For Rome requires showing deference to the emperor. For you do not regard people with partiality. Well, they're sounding like, okay, we're getting ready to set the trap. So here comes the question. Okay, tell us what you think, Jesus. Now, he's aware of their malice. And first, he notes, and he knows that they're testing him and they're baiting him, so to speak. And then Jesus goes on with the brilliant response. He says, show me the coin that's used for tax. They bring him a coin. The coin produced is called a tyrant half shekel, otherwise known as a Roman denarius, and they were minted in the Roman city of Tyre, somewhere around 126 BC to about 56 AD, and it was used as a means of paying the temple tax. In fact, they were even closing the mint in Tyre. Roman authorities allowed the Jewish people to continue to mint those coins in the area known as Palestine as long as they continued to bear the image of the Roman Emperor Caesar. Although these coins were used for the religious practices, these coins clearly impressed upon them that they were nevertheless owned by Rome, and that the Jewish faith existed only because of Romans' favor to the area. So in a sense, Jews were forced to produce and use these religious exchanges as an idolatrous medium, if you would, which also defined them as a member of the Jewish faith community. The temple tax brought them membership into the temple and into the community for a year. And they also were used by buying those sacrificial animals that they were submitting their tithes to. You know, even this kind of practice even crept into the church in the early days, especially over at Pisgah. You'll see it over there if you go over there. And they bought their pews in them years. A lot of times the family bought them, and it was sort of considered like a temple tax. So if you bought your pews, you didn't have to worry about nobody coming in and stealing your seats. But if Jesus answered that tax question with Caesar's image on them, they were going to be threatened. He risked being labeled a dissident, encouraging people to undermine the government, if you would, both Jewish and secular. So if Jesus answered that it's lawful to pay the temple taxes to the emperor, he sets himself up as a lover of Rome, or at least willing to allow Rome's worship of Caesar to supersede Jewish worship and the worship of Yahweh. And by paying the upkeep and the supervision of the temple with the coin that had the head of the Roman emperor on it, they were basically saying, well, it must be ordained by God. And Caesar appears to be selling out this idolatrous invader. Hence, he may lose his followers. Now, Jesus needs to define whose law they need to follow. As a Jewish people subject to Rome, pseudo-paganism, he's a politician, like all the rest, willing to sacrifice faith and power, prestige, at least for the community. He will sell out the people who feels that Rome's graven image is an insult and a sin. So which law prevails? Spiritual law? Jewish law? Roman law? Laws of decency and fairness? Jesus is faced with the dilemma. But here's what he does. This is interesting. Always, one of the greatest teaching methods of all time is asking a question and answering with a question. So Jesus did this. He said, okay, guys, whose head's on this coin? Whose title is on there? Well, it's the emperor's. Yeah, Jesus replied. So therefore, give to the emperor the things that belong to the emperor, and to God give the things that belong to God. And now he has them. He's got their attention. For what belongs to the emperor? A coin with a head on it? What belongs to God? Our faith, our deference, our hearts, our souls, the temple, the people, all things created? What belongs to God? You do, and nothing Caesar can do to ever take that away from you. That's what belongs to God, is you, and nobody can take that away from you. They are not serving God by giving Caesar back that coin to bear his image. For every one of them is made, stamped, and sealed by a far greater and more pervasive image, the image of God, stamped on our heart. Every one of us has been created in God's image to be a son and a daughter of God, and we are already signed, sealed, and committed to God by our faith and our allegiance and our relationship with Christ. That's what makes us so unique and so different, that we have a personal relationship with God. We're made in God's image. God's love is stamped on our heart. Now, it's no secular thing. Whether politics, wealth, threat, or demand can ever take that from us. So let the secular world create its own idols, its own currency, if you would, and its own politics. And yeah, even their own power plays. Because God's people know in their heart that God is so much greater than any of these. And all the things, sacred and secular, belong ultimately to God. You see, we live in a world in which currency matters. And as a citizen of the world, we can take part in that currency. But it does not have to define us. For we are citizens of the kingdom of heaven. And as disciples of Christ, Christians of the church, we can navigate with a currency of love, and that currency bears the image of God in heaven. So as we enter into most of the tumultuous times in our country's history, I wanted to encourage you to remember who you are. You are a child of God. I always liked that song, the old hymn, that I never understood what it meant. I always thought it was God is trying to help us get over a rock or a boulder or something. Over the tumult. You remember that hymn? We go over the tumult. And what it means is God's taken us over the tumultuous problems that are facing us all the time. He's always with us. He's always helping us to get over the tumult, if you would. Now, you may adhere to a party or a political party, and that's okay. You might even have a different economic preference or system of your choice, and you may play the game of life, whether any which way you want to choose. The game of life, it's your choice. But as Christians, people who follow Christian teaching, never forget whose image is sealed into our heart and whose currency must supersede the rest. Christ Jesus, who sacrificed his life to save ours. God, who created you and sustained you in all of these trying times, my prayer is for you that God will bless you in your living, will bless you in your giving, and more importantly, bless you in your loving. Amen.